Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and a very warm welcome to this edition of Africa Link. My name is Jen Nyinge.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe, hosting the program.
Coming up on today's program, Uganda sets up a committee to enforce laws on pornography, but women have raised concerns over possible victimization.
Anybody on the streets who sees a woman who is indecently dressed according to them will take the law into their hands. It's going to be a country of lawlessness. It's going to be a country of mass abuse of women, and that is something we are against today.
And tensions on the rise after North Korea fires a missile over Japan. But is Japan capable of defending itself against such aggression?
Both Japan and the United States have ships equipped with the Aegis shoot-down system. And it really depends if those ships are in the right place at the right time. We don't see any evidence that they tried to shoot the missile down today.
These stories plus much more and also your responses coming up shortly. But first, let's hear what has been happening around the globe.
I'm Shane Meineke with DW News. German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel has condemned North Korea's ballistic missile test that flew over northern Japan early Tuesday, saying he was dismayed by how brutally North Korea has violated UN sanctions and international law. Gabriel added that Germany would work together with the U.S. and other world powers to get North Korea to abide by international sanctions, which is aimed at making Pyongyang give up its missile and nuclear program. Gabriel is expected to meet with U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in Washington later on Tuesday. German Chancellor Angela Merkel held her annual summer press conference in Berlin, where she confidently outlined her campaign strategies less than 4 weeks ahead of Germany's federal election. With her conservative Christian Democrats polling ahead of competition, Merkel carefully answered questions from reporters on Turkey, the EU, and even on border controls.
A lot remains to be done. We've achieved border controls and have rescued refugees in the Mediterranean. But in order to reach a permanent solution with the countries of origin, we need to help locally and fight the causes of migration.
German prosecutors have charged a suspect with attempted murder in connection with a bombing of a bus in Dortmund in April. The 28-year-old suspect denied being behind the attack that injured Dortmund defender Mark Batra and a police officer, but prosecutors believe they have enough evidence to connect him with the bombing. The case is likely to go to trial in 2018. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Historic flooding and heavy rain from Hurricane Harvey has hit hard the U.S. state of Texas and Louisiana on Tuesday, as U.S. President Donald Trump said he would visit storm-battered Texas to assess the damages. With more rain forecasted, a government official from Texas warned reporters that many people are still in danger.
They can't get out of town. I mean, right now, that city is a lake, and all the major arteries going in and out of that city are flooding, so we want them to be safe.
Libya's Coast Guard has saved nearly 500 mostly African migrants off its coast near Tripoli and Sabratha. A spokesman said 7 women and 6 children were included in the rescue effort, which comes after Libya, 4 European countries, and 3 African states agreed to slow the flow of migrants from making the dangerous Mediterranean journey and to prevent people smugglers from exploiting asylum seekers. And now, in other news, government officials in Uganda have set up an ethics committee to search for porn users. As Ethics Minister Simon Lokato says, porn is, quote, one of the deadliest moral diseases to hit the East African country. According to the minister, the committee would be outfitted with high-end tech gadgets and would receive roughly $500,000 per year to stop internet users from distributing or using pornographic materials. Anyone caught could risk imprisonment. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
Welcome once again to the program. Coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. We begin today's program in Uganda, where the government has set up a pornography control committee to wage war on the spread of pornographic material in the country, which has been blamed for the spread of HIV and a high dropout, especially among the girls. The 9-member committee will get an yearly budget of $500,000 to help it in executing its mandate. From Uganda, Alex Gita with the details.
Cool down. I don't want pornography, and Uganda doesn't want pornography. Other things you will have it, but pornography material, no.
Uganda's Minister for Ethics and Integrity, Simon Lokodo, announcing the newly formed Pornography Control Committee. The 9-member committee has hit the ground running, with its major role being early detection of pornographic materials. Apart from banning distribution, watching or listening to pornographic materials, it will ensure implementation of a law that bans women from wearing miniskirts and short dresses, and also restricting men from wearing tight clothes. This has not gone well with some of the people I spoke to.
Anybody on the streets who sees a woman who is indecently dressed, according to them, will take the law into their hands. It's going to be a country of lawlessness. It's going to be a country of mass abuse of women, and that is something we are against today.
Government is failing to pay teachers, it's failing to pay doctors, and we are trying to put up a committee to pay it to do what actually the police is already doing.
We don't need another law to do that. We have on the field implemented the existing laws.
The committee has been allocated 2 billion Uganda shillings, approximately 430,000 euros a year, to do its job. Minister Lokodo says the government had to move in after people started misusing technology.
Pornography had unfortunately encompassed the entire nation. So the role and job of this committee is so wide. We want to appreciate the fact that science has brought us this improvement and development of technology. But this has been abused, unfortunately, so that instead of using the technology for the good purpose, it has been unfortunately diverted to the use of pornography, the telephone, a TV, a radio. Now it's no longer for the purpose for which it was meant, communication. It is now for dirty stories.
Lokodo said the use of pornography has contributed to the increase of drug abuse, incest, teenage pregnancies, rape, and homosexuality. The committee is also expected to sensitize Ugandans about the dangers of pornography and also rehabilitate pornography addicts. Anyone found in possession of pornographic material could face a jail term of up to 10 years. Media houses who publish any material considered to be pornographic could be permanently closed.
Alex Gita in Uganda with that report. Isaac, I'm sure there are so many comments.
Definitely there. Francis God says pornography has killed our youth and the future of Africa. Good move there. And Imongit Dennis says this is the best job. Imagine spending 2 billion and being paid to watch porn. And of course, stop it.
And there is this one from Nikki Nkorote. And says, like, seriously, that's Uganda's biggest problem.
Derek Tower, who is in Berlin, says, I think people are spending too much time on the internet, mainly as a distraction. But such measures need proper execution with a strategy on how to get people focused on more productive things. Keep those comments flowing, and you can write anything you want about this story by visiting our Facebook page, DW Africa. Leaders of France, Germany, Italy, and Spain agreed on a new policy to grant asylum to vulnerable migrants who apply for protection while in Africa instead of their destination countries. At a Europe-Africa summit in Paris aimed at finding long elusive solutions to illegal migration, the European leaders also agreed to help the African countries through which Europe-bound migrants usually pass with border controls. Shortly before we came on air, I spoke to Philip Frisch from Doctors Without Borders in Berlin, who have been helping refugees stranded on the Mediterranean Sea, often on rickety boats. And I started by asking him whether this plan by EU leaders was feasible to deal with the migration issue. Take a listen.
There are some aspects in this plan that sound good on the first glance, especially as they also mentioned the necessity to increase legal and safe pathways to reach Europe. But on the other hand, you have to see it as part of a bigger picture. And the bigger picture so far has been that the European countries have done a lot not to limit the suffering or alleviate the suffering of people in flight, but more almost to just hide the suffering, to make it less visible for the public. And in this context, this plan also can be seen as a plan to basically externalize the frontiers, the borders of the European Union, even further into the African continent, and then also to basically leave people that are, for example, trapped in Libya where they are. And this is a situation that we can just not agree with.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel said EU countries must clearly define which asylum seekers have legitimate humanitarian needs and who is fleeing from poverty. This is going to be a big challenge for the EU, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it is a challenge that the EU has to deal with. On the other hand, you have to see, given the situation that we see in Libya right now, and we have not only people working there directly in some of the camps, but also we interviewed a lot of people that we saw on our boats then on the Mediterranean after we rescued them from immediate danger of drowning. And people that are in Libya right now, they have a legitimate reason to flee, regardless of the reason they had in the first place to leave their country of origin. And that is because Libya is in this kind of horrible state that it is right now. What we really would need is a shift in focus, because right now everybody seems to focus on how to keep people away from reaching Europe and how to basically cover up their suffering. And instead we need to focus on how can we bring help to those people that are so desperately in need of help, and that includes especially those people that are trapped in Libya.
I was speaking to Philip Fritsch from Doctors Without Borders. Isaac Godwin, writing from Liberia, says the African migrant issue isn't something we see to be of the past in this coming decade. Even with the EU pledge, I think it will only minimize, but with difficulty to stop. Those in search for a better life are on the rise.
Eric Kobina from Ghana says, I think it's a good move for the European Union to stop migrants from Africa from entering Europe. This will put pressure on their various countries' governments to put some mechanism in place to create employment for the youth.
Esper from Tanzania says, stopping African migrants is not good. Europe knows why Africans cross the Mediterranean. So Europe can help Africa end wars which are in some parts of Africa. Can someone want to become a refugee? I think not. Let Africans live where they feel comfortable.
Moving on, US President Donald Trump has said all options are on the table in response to North Korea firing a ballistic missile over Japan. Trump said the action signals contempt for standards of international behavior. Japan has reacted sharply to the launch, the first over its territory in 8 years, calling it an unprecedented threat. The UN Security Council is set to hold an emergency session to discuss Pyongyang's action. Earlier in the day, Trump spoke to his Japanese counterpart on North Korea's continued aggression. And for more about that conversation, here is Sophia Jack, a journalist with Tokyo News.
Well, Prime Minister Abe agreed with President Trump in the phone call this morning that they will seek an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, and we'll go from there. But we can expect Japan to dial up its pressure on both China and Russia to play a more constructive role, putting more diplomatic and economic pressure on North Korea to stop what it's doing.
Okay, now did this missile, Sophie, at any time pose an actual threat to the people on Hokkaido?
Well, there's always a risk that the missile could break up in flight and that falling debris could endanger people below. You heard that air raid siren there. A message in Japanese told people to shelter in sturdy buildings or underground. But we've heard from people in Hokkaido who said they were scared because they didn't know where to go. This is a relatively sparsely populated part of Japan, and they said there's just not the facilities in their neighborhood that could handle an impact like that.
Okay, well, does Japan, in fact, have the capacity to shoot down these types of North Korean missiles?
Well, both Japan and the United States have ships equipped with the Aegis shoot-down system. And it really depends if those ships are in the right place at the right time. We don't see any evidence that they tried to shoot the missile down today. Japan also has ground-based Patriot anti-missile batteries, but experts say that those can only shoot down a missile that's headed right for Japan and not one that's passing over it.
Sophia Jack speaking to DW's Brian Thomas.
Welcome once again to the program. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host.
And my name is Jane Nyinge.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, two legal activists hoping to secure the release of young offenders who are locked up with hardcore criminals in Malawi's notoriously congested prisons.
When we went to our Zomba maximum security prison, we found 197 child offenders who were there illegally.
And we are looking forward to your responses. Please talk to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa, or leave us a voice note on our WhatsApp. Don't forget to leave your name and location because we would love to know whom we are speaking to.
That's right, indeed. But first to Kenya, where the petition to nullify the re-election of President Uhuru Kenyatta continues in the capital, Nairobi, and is expected to end on Thursday, clearing the way for 6 Supreme Court judges to deliver their judgment. Already, one of the lawyers representing Kenya's Electoral Commission has legally discredited submissions made by the presenter of the petition's opposition leader, Raila Odinga. Meanwhile, independent legal experts are giving their overview of submissions so far made at the court by parties involved in the petition. James Shimanyula reports from Nairobi.
A Kenyan independent legal expert has presented an overview of the petition against Uhuru Kenyatta and the Electoral Commission.
Allegations against the IEBC and the president are very, very fatal because they may even drift this country into a civil strife if they are not well handled by the judiciary. Lawyers participating in the case have top legal minds, will articulate the law and the facts, and will not be allowed to be swayed by the political affiliations in their hearts. Now, the general public is waiting anxiously for this decision because this decision will make the judiciary or break it.
However, in his lengthy submission, renowned and veteran lawyer Patrick Lumumba, who is representing Kenya's Electoral Commission, explained to the 7 judges of the Supreme Court why the Commission's declaration that Uhuru Kenyatta had won the 2017 presidential election should not be changed.
This court should be very reluctant to overturn the will of the people of Kenya unless it can be demonstrated that indeed that will was subverted.
Using a rare analogy to show that Uhuru Kenyatta won and his victory should not be nullified, Professor Lumumba brought this factor to the judges.
Your lordships and your ladyships, ours is midwifery. We delivered a baby. That baby is alive and well. You are being asked to strangle the baby. Decline the invitation. Decline the invitation because the baby is alive and well.
Apart from well-known and relatively unknown lawyers representing Kenya's Electoral Commission, as well as opposition leader Raila Odinga and President Uhuru Kenyatta, the Supreme Court has allowed 3 so-called friends of the court to make legal independent submissions. Kenya's Attorney General, Githu Muigai, one of them, has a terse explanation of a friend of the court.
A friend of the court is a party who comes to assist the court to appreciate either a special set of laws or a special set of circumstances or facts. He is not aligned to any party. He's not for either party.
That report was compiled by James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Africa on the move.
Now, just like many African countries, Malawian prisons are widely known for their horrific conditions. Inmates wait for longer periods as investigations are carried out, and the worst part of it, young petty offenders are simply locked away with hardcore criminals. Most of them don't even know they have a right to a lawyer. That's where Steve Sikwese and Alfred Munika, 2 legal activists, come in handy. This report by Eugen Schneider is now presented by Lina Ja.
Steve Sikwese and Alfred Munika on the daily routine of visiting inmates being held at police stations and prisons in Malawi. The cells are overcrowded and often young inmates are mixed together with older hardcore criminals. Steve has been helping convicts for many years. It all started with a friend in prison who nobody wanted to help.
I saw an advert in the newspaper looking for people who are interested to join Paralegals. And I said, oh my God, this can be an opportunity that I can start helping people who are in need of help in terms of those who are arrested and then they don't have anybody to assist them.
Many of the young inmates are in jail for petty crimes like theft. They often steal because of grinding poverty. Steve will negotiate with the police on whether they can be released on police bond. He says many inmates are simply locked away without proceedings, without ever seeing a judge, although that violates the Penal Code of Malawi.
People suspected of committing crimes should be dealt with accordingly and in time. Taking a person into custody, rotting the cell for 5 months, 6 months, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, then where's the criminal justice system?
It is usually the policemen who decide on detention. A mere suspicion is often enough to end up in jail. This is the reason why Steve and Clifford Masiska found a passy in 2000. At that time, the conditions in the judicial system were worse than today.
When we went to our Zomba maximum security prison, we found 197 child offenders who were there illegally. What I mean is they had no papers authorizing them to be in prison. But for them, because they didn't have any legal representation or because they are not familiar with the laws and procedure, they thought that that was in order.
Once in a while, Steve and Alfred visit some of their former clients, like Filipina Maliseni. At only 30, the mother of three has already experienced a lot with the judicial system. I was so confused when I went to prison. The sleeping conditions were very bad, and I had a 7-month-old child. I didn't know how to raise it in prison, and what would happen to my other kids at home. The conditions in prison were very hard. Stephen Alfred helped secure her release, and she has been with her children for the past 2 years.
She was arrested on the offense of murder, and she stayed in prison for 3 years and 4 months without being taken to court, without any trial. So we applied for bail, which she was released on bail.
Since her release, she hasn't heard from the court. Legal aid for prisoners is a success model that other African countries like Uganda and Kenya have adopted.
Lina Ja with that report compiled by Eugene Schneider.
Focus Europe.
For our focus on Europe this week, we take you to Britain that is preparing to mark a sad anniversary. On August 31st, it will be 20 years since the death of Diana, Princess of Wales. The 36-year-old died in a car crash in central Paris. From London, Stephen Baird looks back at the life and death of one of the most remarkable royals in recent British history.
The news, when it came out of the blue at the end of August in 1997, was truly shocking.
This is BBC Radio News from London. Buckingham Palace has announced the death of Diana, Princess of Wales.
The divorced wife of the heir to the British throne had died in a car crash in Paris. The BBC treated the tragedy like the death of a sovereign. Diana was a kind of monarch for the modern age, the ultimate international celebrity, socialite, charity worker, secular saint, a source of scandal, an object of adoration. A style icon, says fashion expert Kerry Taylor, who shook the British monarchy to its foundations.
I mean, she was a new kind of royal. In Britain, I think, we hadn't seen the human face of royalty before. The vulnerability, the sadnesses. She made the British royal family change in so many ways.
It's not too much of an exaggeration to say she changed Britain too. Her sudden death triggered extraordinary public displays of grief.
Oh, God! Oh, my God!
Many wept openly outside Kensington Palace, a show of emotion all the more striking because it was happening in Britain, a country once famous for its emotional restraint. The Prime Minister of the day, Tony Blair, astutely cashed in on the national mood.
She was the people's princess, and that's how she will stay, how she will remain in our hearts and in our memories.
But controversial to the end, Diana, even in death, divided the nation. While millions mourned extravagantly, many Brits deplored the outpouring. And conservative intellectual Digby Anderson pointed out, perhaps rather primly, that Diana had died after a series of well-publicised love affairs and after a hectic summer of yacht hopping in the Mediterranean.
At the particular moment this happened, she was in dallying around with a playboy while her children were in another country. She did not act as a wonderful traditional role model. And there's a lot in her behaviour which was self-indulgent, self-obsessed, This wasn't a saint, and the attempt to try to canonise her is a nonsense.
But canonised she was. The princess embraced outcast Indian untouchables, leprosy victims in Indonesia. She campaigned against landmines. She used her celebrity to promote her favourite causes, and thanks to her glamour and thanks to the scandal around her failing marriage, that celebrity was enormous, says her spin doctor, Dicky Arbiter.
Diana had so much press. There wasn't a magazine front cover that she didn't appear on. There was a newspaper that she didn't appear on its front pages. There wasn't a time when she wasn't being talked about. She was constant media fodder.
With all the trappings of royalty, combined with glamour, sex, scandal, compassion and tragedy, Diana's story is as compelling as ever and continues to reverberate. The popularity of her former husband, Prince Charles, has just nosedived, according to the latest poll. Only a third of Britons think he's been good for the monarchy. Only 14% want his second wife, Camilla, to become queen. Diana, said one newspaper here, is the ghost that still haunts the future king. After 20 years, her legacy lingers.
Stephen Beard reporting on the anniversary of the late Princess of Wales, Diana.
And we have a comment from Kampala, Uganda, and Charles Ongole John says, the late Princess Diana was surely a candle in the wind of UK. The world was shocked by her passing on.
Now, to South Sudan, we've been reporting on the death of an American journalist. It was alleged that he was killed by unknown assailants, and we posted something about his death on our Facebook page and some comments for you. Ajun Noel Julius says, many journalists have died since the war broke out in South Sudan. Chris Allen's death is a manifestation of risks war covering journalists face. And Census Dolyong says, may their souls rest in peace. I'm now intrigued at how they were killed. Crossfire, in prison, frontline, at home, etc.
And Itat Media says, Human Rights Watch should not speak only when an American journalist is killed. A lot of killing and arrest is being perpetrated by certain dictatorial rulers in Africa, and nothing is being said about it.
Bitangimana Astel Paul says, UN and Human Rights Watch should take strong measures on African dictators.
And Didans from Rwanda says that journalist rest in peace, and I sympathize with his family, his great hero, because he died while searching news to show African conflicts are ravaging our continent.
Now, back to your comments, as we promised that we might find time or would we find time to read them about our top story today. Uganda setting up a committee to fast track the banning of pornography. Milo Kiloto says, whoever comes up with such policies and broadcast all over international media making us look all daft.
And Samuel Okelogum says, 2 billion shillings for anti-pornography bill. Uganda is going nuts while pregnant women are still dying in hospitals.
I think many people are commenting that, you know, the resources are not being fully utilized. You know, there are some more bigger things that the government ought to look at rather than the anti-pornography bill. Because as you heard in the report, women are complaining that they might be victims of assault.
Absolutely.
Especially if there some people think that they're poorly dressed.
And just to add on that, you know, like in Kenya where I come from, you see these committees are being formed, but they do nothing at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
The people who benefit are the people who are in these committees.
Yeah, Moses Walgembe says, so you buy a porn detector at 2 billion shillings, but with a scrambling healthcare system. And Elizabeth Wall says, absolute waste of resources. Our hospitals have no drugs and government thinks a porn detector is priority. My tax money, painful.
And this one from Gonzaga Gonza says, they tax people's money to invest in senseless projects. Can you imagine?
Leonard Lubwama asks, is this all the country needs? Will the Entebbe killings stop once this machine comes? Well, we really appreciate your comments. Keep them sending, and we'll always read them whenever we come live here on Africa Link. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jane Nyinge.
Bye-bye for now.